used to say that he liked his hockey teams to be truculent. Kind of in the image of himself. He's been the general manager of 5 different NHL teams, a record. You know him, I know him, but how well do we know him? Brian Burke, this time on Spotlight. Good to see you.
Thanks for having me on.
Dual citizen now of the United States and Canada. You grew up in Providence, Rhode Island, and the family moved a bit before you settled in Minnesota. Why, Dad was working in different places? What happened?
My dad was in sales, and he kept getting promoted and having kids. So after he was in the Navy in World War II, and then he went to Fordham University on a GI Bill. And then when he graduated, he went to work for Sunbeam Appliances, which is around to this day. They make really good stuff. And they sent him to St. Louis and then Milwaukee. He had 2 kids in Milwaukee, then Providence, and he had 2 more in Providence, then Philadelphia, and he had 3 more in Philadelphia, and then Chicago, and he had 3 more, and that was at 10. So then we moved briefly to Boston, and then we moved to Minnesota when I was 12, and we stayed there.
Is that where you found hockey?
Yep.
Why not any place before that?
I played, we had a pond behind our house in Boston. I played hockey once or twice, just pond hockey.
On skates or in boots?
Skates.
Yeah.
But, you know, I was terrible. You can't learn to skate quickly. So I got my first cut playing on the pond, though. I got my first stitches in my eyebrow. I remember that. But really didn't play till we moved to Minnesota. I was 12, and I started playing the next fall at 13.
Peer pressure? I mean, Minnesota's a hockey hotbed. It's one of the biggest sports in that state, certainly.
It's number one. And it's when I moved there, we got stuck at a Howard Johnson's motel with 10 kids for 3 days because there was a blizzard, and the moving van got stuck coming out west from Boston. Mm. And so we were stuck for 3 days, and the Minnesota State High School tournament was on. And, you know, that's a big deal in Minnesota. They used to play at the Met where the North Stars played. Mm-hmm. And they would get a sold-out crowd Thursday night, Friday night, Saturday. And I just fell in love with the game.
Your parents, or maybe more accurately your dad, I don't know which, had a unique thing that you did at the dinner table every night. You had to come up with a new word. You had to define it, use it in a sentence. How'd that all start?
Both my parents thought, like, we could all read and write before we got to school. Same with all my kids could, too. My mom and dad taught us, and I remember going to kindergarten, and the teacher was a nun, Sister Maria Melda, and she caught me writing something and said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I'm just writing a note." And she said, "Well, we don't teach writing here till next year." I said, "Well, you're a little late." So my parents made us come to the table with a vocabulary word every night. One, not every kid, not 10 words, just one word. So on Wednesday night, it might be my turn, and I'd have to come with a vocabulary word, define it, spell it, use it in a sentence, just to build vocabulary among the kids.
Did the other kids pay attention?
Yeah, we all had to do it. So, yeah, it was.
But you had a rotation.
We had a rotation, and then we had reading hour every night, too. We had to sit in the living room and read as a family for an hour, and it couldn't be schoolwork. It was library books.
What do you think that, I mean, other than impacting on you as a father and what you did with your kids, what did that wind up meaning to you?
Well, it taught me a love of reading. I don't go anywhere without a book, usually 2 books. I usually have 3 books on the go, usually one that I read on the plane, one that I keep in the Toronto house, and one that I keep in the Calgary house. Obviously, I'm going to sell the Calgary house now, but taught me a lifelong love of reading and a love of the English language. Came in very handy all my life to when I got to law school, plowing through mountains of documents and, you know, sometimes 600 pages of reading for the next day. It wasn't daunting at all.
Do you think we're losing that in society today? You have kids of a variety of ages. You've grown kids and you have younger kids. Do they read enough, in your opinion?
Yeah, my kids all read, so I'm pretty happy with that. We never allowed any video games or any of that stuff. They don't watch hardly any TV, so they still, all 5 of my kids still read.
You obviously love sports. You played football and rugby, as well as hockey. Did you go to rugby after hockey?
Yes.
Why?
Well, when I quit playing, I played, started 13, you're late, right? You're 6-7 years behind everyone.
Hockey. Yeah.
And so I had to work my tail off, and thank God for outdoor rinks, because that's where I did all the work, was after school, go skate outside.
Yeah.
And we're losing that with climate change, but that was what allowed me to succeed. And I walked on as a freshman at Providence College, and for people who are listening who don't know that term, it means you're recruited, but you don't get any scholarship money. Right. You've got to make the team and beat out a scholarship kid, which I did. And my ice time the first year was pretty limited, and then Lou put me on a half scholarship for my second year, Lou Lamorello, and then full ride my last 2 years, and I was captain my senior year with Ronnie Wilson. So then I signed with the Flyers after I got done my college career. I played 7 games in Springfield in the American League, and the Flyers signed me after that. I played the next year in Maine, in Portland, Maine, for the Flyers farm team, the Maine Mariners. We won the Calder Cup, won the AHL mm-hmm. championship, but I wasn't very good, so I went back to school. And
you went to Harvard.
Yeah, I went to Harvard Law School. And spring of my first year, I was riding my 10-speed back to my apartment to study, and I saw a guy in a rugby sweater. I had never played, but my older brother had played a little bit. And so I said, what team do you play for? He said, the Harvard Business School. And I said, who's that open to? He said, any graduate student at Harvard. So I said, well, I'm in the law school. He said, well, that counts, so come on out to practice. So I bought a kit. I bought boots and a pair of shorts and a sweater and started playing rugby.
Where you went? That's intriguing, because I would have associated the fact that you played football. Now, I assume you played football in high school.
High school football, yeah.
Yeah, not at Providence.
No.
So you play, I mean, there is a relationship you would understand between North American football and rugby. It's a clear relationship. It's not uncommon for somebody who, you know, maybe doesn't make a team or gravitates towards the game of rugby because they find it more interesting or more challenging or whatever. But that wasn't the case with you. You didn't go straight from football in high school to rugby. There is at least a 4 or 5 year gap in between.
5 years. And I loved high school football. I loved the physicality of it. But what really fascinated me, what I really fell in love with, was the planning. Football is such an organized sport. You know, we have a playbook, and I'm the starting left guard, and if I miss my block, the play doesn't work. So there's a great deal of interdependence, which I liked. I liked being on a team with guys that needed each other. And I missed it. When I quit playing hockey, I missed it. So I played, you know, like intramural hockey in law school. But rugby was a great gap filler for me. It put me on a team with some really good guys. I'm friends with a lot of them to this day. And we didn't play an academic schedule. The Harvard Business School played in the top league in New England. So I played against probably 10 American Eagles that played for the national team. We played Beacon Hill, Bunker Hill. We played Concord, New Hampshire, all the top teams in rugby in New England. And I thought it was pretty good rugby until I moved to Vancouver as the assistant GM and went and watched a couple of their local clubs play. And I thought, good God, thank God we never played these guys.
With Brian Burke. Let's go back to Lou Lamorello. So you meet him. He was the coach at Providence University. Providence College. You could not have known where Lou Lamorello's career would take him. In fact, I think you would acknowledge that someone who coaches at a college generally doesn't go into the pros. Usually, if you're in a university atmosphere, that's usually where you stay. There have been guys that have been successful in making that transformation, but I would say there are probably more that have failed in trying to go from college sports to professional sports.
For sure.
What was it about Lou?
Well, Lou's got, there's a lot about Lou that's he doesn't talk much about himself. So you have to learn about Lou from other people like me that played for him. And I think the one thing that was common or obvious, even at that time, even when I met him in the fall of 1973, was that this was a serious guy. He was a guy who spent all his time preparing for what was in front of him. And he was fortunate enough to meet the former owner of the Devils, Dr. McMullen. Mm-hmm. And both strict Catholics, both devout Catholics, and hit it off. So the same month that I joined, or right about the same 60-day period that I joined Vancouver, I left my law practice and went to Vancouver as the assistant GM. He went to the Devils as GM. But you're right, very few people. It's a very unusual leap.
What was it about him, though? What did you see in him that gave you an indication that he was going to have this, well, 50-year career in hockey?
I would say that he would not accept losing. And, like, you just knew. I think if Lou had opened a bakery, it would be the biggest bakery in the United States. I think if Lou had bought a car dealership, it would be, they'd have 30 of them now. Like, he's a guy that just knows how to get to someplace and then works his tail off till he gets there.
One of the stories, not to make this about Lou, last question about him, but there are stories about him, and one involving you, I think, practicing at 4 a.m. or something, or 2 a.m. in the middle of the night.
4 in the morning.
As a, well, for lack of a better term, a punishment for something.
Yeah, it was late for practice.
Yeah.
On Christmas Day. Like, everyone in the Western world had Christmas Day off.
You had a practice.
We had practice. And my alarm didn't go off. And I didn't find out till much later that Ronnie Wilson had snuck into my room and unplugged my alarm as a prank. But some prank. I had to skate at 4 in the morning for 9 straight days for being late.
Wow. You graduate from law school here, to take you back, in 1981. You become an NHL player agent. Not too surprising. It combines the two things that you had, the activity that you had done playing hockey and this law degree that you now had. How'd that go?
Well, I didn't plan on the one lesson. When I talk to groups of young people and students, I always tell them, I said, I didn't plan for anything that's happened in my life. Like, I had no intention of going to law school. Like, when I was a senior, Lou called me in and he had the LSAT, the application to take the law boards.
Mm-hmm.
And he slid it across the desk and he said, you're taking this exam. If you do well, your professors tell me you got a shot at Harvard or Yale. So I looked at it, LSAT, I shoved it back. I said, I have no interest in going to law school. I had my career planned out. I was going to get my master's in history. I was a history major, and I wanted to teach and coach in college. I had it all planned. I signed up for the GREs for history. And Lou said, you don't understand. That was not a request. And he shoved it back. He said, you're taking the exam. So I said, coach, I have no interest in going to law school. Why would I take the exam? He said, just take it. He said, you might blow it away. You never know. So you can take a course to study for the LSAT that lasts 3 months, right? I got the thing. There's a booklet that explained how it worked. It was like 22 pages long. I read the booklet twice. I had a cold beer. I went to bed. So I get up the next day. I was late for practice that day. Lou let me be late for practice to take the test. So I took the test. And anyone listening that's taken the test, it's very confusing. You know, a lot of the questions you can get, it's 4 multiple choice. You can get it down to 2 and then you're guessing, right? So I got done, and I had the worst migraine I've ever had in my life. So I go down to the rink, run down to the rink because I'm late, put on my gear, I go out on the ice, and Lou said, how was it? And I said, I have no idea. I said, I just know I have the worst headache I've ever had in my life. So you wait about a month, and you get the envelope back from the Educational Testing Service in Princeton, and you know it's your LSAT. So I didn't have the nerve to open it at my mailbox. I went upstairs where there's no one around and opened it in case I bombed it.
Yeah.
Well, I got a 702 or a 705 or something on it. I was in the 98th percentile.
Whoa.
Of people that took the exam that year.
You guessed good.
I guessed good. So now Harvard's a real possibility. So now I'm getting the applications and writing. So I got accepted to Harvard. I got accepted to Georgetown. And the same week I got both those acceptances, I scored my only hat trick in 4 years of college. We played New Hampshire. They were ranked number 6 in the country, and I got 3.
It's a good week.
It's a good week.
What was on the test? What kinds of questions?
Lots of
law stuff.
No, it was you get a complicated fact situation, and then they'd ask you questions about it. So you'd read like a 400-word paragraph about.
Okay.
It could be about a guy buying a house, and then the questions would be, what was the first offer? Who did he buy the house from? Like, it's retention, and you've got to zip through this. It may sound easy to people listening, but you've got to read that essay carefully and then answer 10 questions and then go on to the next one. You only have a limited amount of time. So it's very draining. There's some logic questions on it, some multiple choice vocabulary questions on it. I think I just had a good day.
So general interest. It isn't specifically about the law at all.
No.
So now you pass this. Now you have an opportunity to go to law school. But You told Lou you had no interest in law. What changed?
Well, I think, like, Providence College is an excellent school, but it's a small Catholic school.
Yeah.
Nobody from Providence College had gotten into Harvard Law School in 10 years.
Really?
10 years. And that year, myself and a wonderful female student named Angela Carcone, who I'm friends with to this day, both got accepted.
Wow.
So what complicated things for me was after my third year, after my junior year, the Flyers had claimed my rights. So in the old system, if you didn't draft a guy, you could claim his rights later, and they claimed my rights. So I was thinking maybe the Flyers will give me some kind of shot. So when I got the acceptance letter from Harvard, again, I was, it's a real thin envelope, right? It's one sheet. It's not like here's a dorm application. It's one sheet. So I didn't have the nerve to open it down in front of my mailbox. Again, I ran upstairs and it says you've been accepted to Harvard. And
Holy cow.
Was a thing in there that they would grant 40 deferments each year. So I applied for a deferment right away. So my admission was pushed back a year in case the Flyers signed me. I didn't know if they would or not.
I see.
So then the Flyers asked me to play 7 games in Springfield. That was their farm team that year. And it was a split farm team. It was 10 Washington guys and 10 Philadelphia guys. And I did not play much, and I did not play well except for one game. It's the one game Mr. Keith Allen was the GM who signed me. He came to that game. We played New Haven. One of our wingers got tossed on the first play of the game off the opening faceoff, so I had to play. And I got to play a lot, and I had a couple big hits and caught a guy on a breakaway and tried to start a couple fights. And
so he sees this, he goes, well,
we'll give him a shot.
This Burke guy can play a little bit.
Yeah.
So that you get your shot.
So I signed with the Flyers and played that year in Maine. We had a great year. We won the Calder Cup. Great bunch of guys.
Then what? You wind up going to Harvard, though.
Yeah, I went back to school the next fall. I didn't have a good year. I had trouble. All the things that made me successful, like hard work and being a cerebral player, being a coach's dream, being a good teammate, all those things, all our guys could do all that, and they were better than I was. That was when the age gap caught up with me. So this is my, my first year was 13, so now I'm 22. So it was my ninth year of organized hockey, 10th year of organized hockey. I couldn't catch up.
How much did you make in Maine?
I got $10,000 to sign and $15,000 to play.
Was money important to you?
No, but that's back then. That's what guys from my class were making coming out into the business world, getting 15 to 17 grand. That's what the jobs paid back then. So 15 plus 10, I bought a Jeep.
Yeah, so it was okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're not getting rich.
No.
But it's okay.
Yeah, and my NHL salary, had I played in the NHL, was $55,000, which was pretty good money back then.
Yeah. 1987, Pat Quinn hires you to be the director of hockey operations for the Vancouver Canucks. Did you know Pat? Had you run into him? Had you met him someplace?
Well, Pat was an assistant coach with the Flyers at my first training camp. And I had a very early admiration for him because the night before we went on the ice, there were 40 or 50 kids at this rookie camp. And someone asked, are we all going to main camp? And an executive of the Flyers said, yes, you're all going to main camp in Philly. And we knew that couldn't be true. They're not taking 50 rookies to a main camp. They already got 25 guys there that played for the Flyers the year before. And they ended up cutting half of the group. But Pat Quinn said on the ice, he said, don't believe that for a second. Half of you guys are going home. So show us what you got.
Yeah.
And he took a little risk saying that, overruling someone above him in the organization. And right away, I thought, I got to get to know this guy better. So when I was in law school, my roommate from Maine that year played for the Flyers for a few years, TJ Gorenz. And I would go down and visit him, drive down from Boston and visit him and find time for Pat. You know, and say, I'm coming down, can you have lunch? And got to be good friends with him and his wife, Sandra, who's just a lovely lady. And just kind of made that friendship happen.
You leave there. You spent 5 years there.
Five years.
And you go to Hartford. The Whalers organization had had some intermittent success. They'd had some high-profile players, the Howes. But anecdotally, it's not a market that people aspired to, really. Hartford's an okay place. I've been there, but there's nothing special about it. But you only lasted a year.
Yep.
Why?
Well, the owner and I didn't see eye to eye. It's a recurring theme in my career. Richard Gordon was his name, and I'll never forget. He gave me my first GM job, and I'm grateful for that. But we didn't see eye to eye on much, and so at the end of the year, we agreed Gary Bettman was looking to hire his first senior VP of hockey operations, and Gary had approached me about the job, and so we agreed that I would switch over to the league at that point. So I went to the NHL in the summer of 93. Now, thank God, before I left, I pulled off the Chris Pronger deal at the draft in Quebec City. So this was the first, everyone remembers the Twins, but my first big draft deal on the floor was Chris Pronger in 93. We had the sixth pick in the draft. We traded up to two and took Chris Pronger. So when I went back in the job market after 5 years at the league, I had a little track record to show because by then he was a star.
Yeah. Was the job offer on the table before you left Hartford, or did you leave not knowing that Gary was looking for somebody or that you could have that job?
I called Gary that day when it looked like it was going to blow up, and he said, okay. He said, well, let's do it. So I said, you talk to me about the job once. If it's still open, I'm interested.
So you become the sheriff of the National Hockey League. Did you like that job?
Well, it was a much bigger job than that. The notion, I did player discipline. I did supplementary discipline. So yeah. I was the sheriff. But I was also involved in collective bargaining with the officials and the players. We had a couple of work stoppages in there. So I was frontline on that. I was involved in international hockey. I went to the board meetings for USA Hockey and Hockey Canada. It was a much bigger job than that. Plus, you have all the regular 4 GM meetings a year, 4 Board of Governor meetings a year where you have to make reports. So it was a great education. I view that as 5 years in a learning phase of my life. And you work with Gary Bettman, it's like getting an MBA from the best school, from Harvard Business School. He's brilliant. And it was, so the discipline part was hard because people, you know, people are really negative around that job. Whatever you do, you're wrong, right? Twice. Yeah. You give a guy 2 games. The team that he plays for thinks you were too hard on him. And the team of the victim thinks you let him off easy.
Yep.
And if it's a French player involved, you're stupid in 2 languages. So it's there's a lot of negativity around the job, but I think it's a really important job. And linked in with all the other stuff I got to do, it was like getting an MBA. It was just a fantastic experience.
I suspect we're all the same. You take a job in a particular line of work, and as you're working your way through that job, and once you, however long it takes, you become comfortable with that, you start envisioning where this job would lead. This job did not or should not have led you back to being directly in hockey, ultimately a general manager back in Vancouver. Where did you think it was going to lead you? I mean, could you see yourself being the president, commissioner of the National Hockey League someday? I mean, what did you fantasize about?
Not that. That job requires someone who's way more political than I am, especially at that point. When Gary came in, the owners were fractured. He was a firefighter for the first 20 years on that job.
Yeah.
Troubled franchises and owners going to prison and moving teams. And it was unbelievable the patience that he showed and the steadiness. And he kept the league on course. And now the league's in better shape than it's ever been.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't envision being the commissioner because Gary's about my age. He wasn't going anywhere. He's, you know, and he's such a brilliant guy. You're not going to take his job. And so I didn't plan anything. I thought he asked me to do 5 years, so I did my 5 years. I came back from the Olympics in Nagano, so we did part of the first Olympics in NHL in Nagano. And I went to him and I said, I can't stand going to games and not caring who wins. That was the worst part of the job. You're going to watch hockey games and you're not caring who wins. You're just hoping your officials don't make any mistakes and you're hoping you don't have to suspend anybody. And I said, I can't stand it. I gotta get back to a team. I gotta get somewhere where the losses and the wins are important. So I was a finalist in Atlanta that year. They were just coming into the league. And I was a finalist in Vancouver. In Vancouver, Gary told the teams they couldn't make a job offer till the day after the Stanley Cup Finals ended. So Washington got swept that year against Detroit. The series ended in Washington. And that night, the Vancouver Canucks called and said, we're making an offer in the morning.
Any question in your mind as to whether you're going to take it or not?
Well, the Atlanta thing was interesting because I know when I started as a GM, I had multiple goals in mind that I wanted to accomplish in my career. Number one being winning a championship, which I've done.
Yep.
Number two was working in Canada because I think it's special working in Canada. I've been able to do that a lot. It's been great. Number three was building an expansion team. And number four was working for an original six team.
So that's why Atlanta under the expansion.
Yeah. And so it was appealing. And, you know, it was, and they actually called me about the job, but never formally offered it to me before I accepted Vancouver. And I'd lived in Vancouver. You know, two of my children were born in Vancouver. So I knew the city. There was no learning curve going back in. I knew the team and I knew the city. So I was really excited.
Talk to me a bit about the Canucks franchise when you went there. There were economic issues. Fan base was fractured is probably the wrong word.
No, I think that's a good word.
Is that the right word for it?
Well, people were really sour about a couple things. One, they had traded Trevor Linden, and Trevor Linden was the most popular player that ever played. Maybe the Twins are now, but Trevor was the most popular player that ever played there.
Mm-hmm.
They had fired Pat Quinn, and Pat Quinn was beloved by everybody in Western Canada and all across Canada. I used to walk through airports with him, and it took 2 hours sometimes to get through an airport. He stopped and talked to everybody.
Yeah.
And so the fan base was really mad. We had Mike Keenan was coach, and he wasn't popular. I fired Mike at the All-Star break and brought in Mark Crawford. But at the end of my first year, we had 7,600 season tickets in Vancouver. We routinely played to crowds of 10 and 11,000. We were losing money, millions and millions of dollars. I think my first year there, we lost $28 million. And we were publicly traded. These aren't losses that some owner is manufacturing.
No.
We were publicly traded. This is real money into the furnace. And so we had to rebuild it. And so I have three pillars on my teams. One is we're going to run it like a business. And you might say to yourself, well, that's pretty obvious. Every team runs like a business. No, they don't. Yep. A lot of them make very poor decisions. And my view was, if we're losing this much money and I put a guy in the minors making $3 million, my season ticket holders think, well, that's our money. You just wasted our money.
Mm-hmm.
So number two is play an entertaining style. So you know how my teams play. My teams play rough hockey. They play black and blue hockey. We try to score a lot of goals. We try to entertain you so that on a night when we're not successful, you still feel the ticket had value. And number three is community service. My players do more in the community than the next two teams combined. So people grew to love our team before we were successful. We started selling out before we started winning because people bought into what we were doing. And at the end of my first year, we made the deal for the Twins, and that's when people realized we were serious.
I'm going to jump ahead. 2005, you go to Anaheim, executive vice president and general manager right before the draft. And that was after the lockout.
The lockout, yeah.
Right. And you wind up winning a Stanley Cup there in 2006-07, beating the Ottawa Senators in five games. You have said that in that year that you won the Stanley Cup in Anaheim, the franchise lost $8 million. Is that
yep.
right?
Correct.
Was that reflective of the marketplace?
Lost six. No, lost eight, but the building made money. We had a ticket tax, and so we netted out okay. We netted out positive. The team lost money on an operating basis, but the building made, so we lost eight, and I think the building made 12. So the owner was fine.
One of the intriguing things here, and you can identify this, is there are many people who don't spend much time in California or never been to California, assume that there are two teams in LA. One is the Kings and the other is the Ducks. But effectively, that really isn't the case. Anaheim is a different city,
yeah,
isn't it?
It is. Well, first off, it's 45 minutes southeast, so you're not sharing that marketplace. The people aren't driving on the 405.
Exactly.
You know, the freeway system there is so bad at rush hour, and that's why if you look, the West Coast teams, most of them start at 7:30 at night to allow people to get there because of the traffic. So it's a distinct marketplace. It's got a really good fan base of around 10,000 hardcore, knowledgeable hockey fans that love the Ducks. And then you've got to win to get the rest of the building full. You've got to have a successful team, which we did. We played in the conference finals my first year, and we won the Stanley Cup my second year.
On November 12, 2008, you stepped down as general manager. The Ducks management submits papers to the NHL, releasing you from your contractual commitment. And 17 days later, you're introduced as the president and general manager of the Toronto Maple Leafs. There are lots of stories about backroom deals, manipulation of the system. Do you want to address that?
Sure.
I know you have before, but
Yeah, there was never any contact from the Toronto Maple Leafs. That's tampering. And certainly, I have no reason to conceal that now if there were. You know, there's nothing anyone could do about it now. But no one from the Toronto Maple Leafs approached me about the job. The Anaheim Ducks initiated that change. So I was in my fourth year of my contract. They offered me a very generous extension, and I said, I can't do this. I'm commuting to Boston to see my older kids every other weekend.
It's too far.
Too far, and it was killing me.
Yeah.
And originally, I could take a flight out of Long Beach, and that was much closer to Anaheim, nonstop to Boston on JetBlue. Well, they got rid of that flight. Now you got to drive all the way to LAX at 5 o'clock in the morning, park, fly 5.5, 6 hours to Boston, drive down to your house, spend the weekend with your kids, fly back. And flying back, it's 6.5, 7 hours because of the headwinds. Mm-hmm. And I remember one time we were on a JetBlue flight coming back. We had to stop for gas in Denver because the winds were so strong. So it was killing me. And I told the Samuelis, who are the owners there, they're just wonderful people, Henry and Susan. I said, look, I'm doing my fourth year. I don't want to get out of my contract. I'm doing the fourth year. I'm finishing the fourth year. But then I get to pick. I won you a cup. If I hadn't won anything here, it'd be different. But now I got to get off that plane. It's much like this decision here to leave the Flames, made in concert with them. But a lot of it is I can't do the commute much more. So they said, if you're not going to be here next year, we'd like to give it to someone who is. I said, well, who's that? And they said, Bob Murray, who was my assistant GM. And I said, great, he'll do a great job. So I stepped aside at their request, and they filed the paperwork. I remember my wife at the time said, is the Toronto job there for you? And I said, I have no idea. I went duck hunting for 2 days in Vancouver.
Well, so we got to take a break here, but 17 days between leaving Anaheim and officially being unveiled in Toronto, and I'm not suggesting for a second that you didn't know during those 17 days that you were coming to Toronto, or at least that they were interested. However, did you spend time, as you were contemplating leaving Anaheim, Brian, what did you think, now what am I going to do?
No, I was here in Toronto when this happened. You tell me, you hold up the hand when we have to break. I was here doing my sports conference, the primetime sports conference that I do here.
Yeah.
And I got a text from my boss, Mike Shulman, who's the lawyer for the Samuelis. He said, I need to talk to you right now. So I said, well, I'm teaching a course, but I said, I'll go upstairs in a half hour. We had the Hockey Hall of Fame that night. And that's when he told me, he said, we need you to step aside. I said, okay. He said, you need to get back here tomorrow. I said, I've got day two of my conference tomorrow. I'll fly back the next day.
So you didn't spend any time contemplating what was next?
No, this all happened. And again, no plan.
Okay. Let's take the break. When we come back, he joins the Toronto Maple Leafs as president and general manager. Brian Burke, this time on Spotlight.
Now, more of Bob McCowan and Primetime Sports on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Nineteen before the hour. Brian Burke, this time on Spotlight. So it's the end of November, and you're in 2008, and you're introduced as the new president and general manager of the Toronto Maple Leafs. Dave Nonis had been by your side in Anaheim and in Vancouver, and you brought him to Toronto. And now here you embark on probably the biggest hockey market in the world, a franchise that hadn't won a Stanley Cup in a long time, 50 years, give or take. Did you think you could do this?
Yep.
Did you think it was going to take a long time?
Yes.
And yet, in some ways, you were fooled by what you thought you had. And let me explain that to you. We spent some time together in the summer before, as you were embarking on this. And you thought you had a real good defense. You thought you had a system where you rated the defenseman. And I'd never heard this before, and you explained it to me. You thought your defense was good enough. You thought you needed a goal scorer, and so you went and did the deal for Kessel. And shortly thereafter, went over to figure out your goaltending situation as well in Europe. Did you overrate your defense? Did your defense not play the way they had? How would you evaluate that scenario? Because it did set you back, Brian.
Yeah, we overrated our defense. I underestimated the impact of the no trade, no move clauses that we had on the team and the difficulty of getting rid of that group that accepted losing. It took longer. In my interview, I told the Leafs it would take 5 years, but I never said that at the press conference because I don't like guys that do that. They say, well, it's going to take 5 years, then they can fail for 5 years.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, the Phil Kessel acquisition was in large part because I thought we had some ticket price fatigue where, okay, if we're not going to win, let's at least have a star player mm-hmm. with what we charge for tickets. And Phil did a good job here and worked out fine. People don't like him, but that's fine. But no, I definitely overrated the defense. And the thing was, the only regret I have is I have no bitterness about getting let go here. That's, you know, the team got sold, and it's the same thing that happened in Vancouver. People buy a team, they want their own people. And so when I interviewed for the job here, I was so gun-shy about the team being sold. I asked the Ontario Teachers' Pension people, I said, are you planning on selling this team? And they're like, no. It's a great success. We're going to keep it. Then they sell a team, mm-hmm. and you get bounced. That team made the playoffs. So I got fired right before the shortened season. That team made the playoffs with one change. With the McLaren kid they picked up, is it Kyle McLaren that they picked up from San Jose, who we were trying to trade for before I got fired. They ended up getting him on waivers. So that team that year was the fastest team in the NHL and the toughest team in the NHL. And that team made the playoffs. So I said, even in the meeting when they fired me, I said, why wouldn't you give me the short season here? If I miss the playoffs, you can fire me, but this team's not going to miss the playoffs. We finally got the formula, and they were like, no, we're making the change.
We hear a lot about this being the media center of the hockey world. You go to a practice, and you will see more media in a scrum in Toronto than anywhere else, and by a large margin, too. I don't think anything intimidates you, but how did you deal with that? Did you like that? Did you respect that? Did you hate that?
Well, you work for the Toronto Maple Leafs. You're stepping out on, you know, as I said in my press conference, this is the Vatican if you're in hockey.
Yeah.
This is the Vatican.
It's the New York Yankees.
It's the New York Yankees. So whatever cliche you want, it's true. And so you can't complain about these things when you get here and say, oh, I didn't know there was this much media coverage. I mean, you're not paying attention then. The issue here is, for me, this is my view of the marketplace, because I'm glad to be moving back to Toronto because I love living in Toronto. I don't miss working in Toronto.
Understood.
So like you say, it's a sheer volume thing. So in Calgary, we might have 30 people in the dressing room after practice. Well, that's 80 or 90 in Toronto. And when you're not successful, they all pick up a rock. And they throw it. So 20 throw it at Dion Phaneuf and 20 at Phil Kessel and 20 at me, 20 at the coach, and then 20 at random targets, you know. So there's an overwhelming negativity in the marketplace that's dictated by the number of media outlets. And it's not so much that the coverage was unfair as it wasn't balanced at all. And so, and again, not making excuses. We didn't win enough games. That's why I got let go. Even if the team being sold, if we'd won more games, they would have had to keep me around. So no complaints, no excuses. Grateful that I got to serve as the general manager of this great team. Grateful that I got to live in Toronto and live here now. So no complaints, but no, I didn't get it done. And it started, as you say, when I first took over the job, I thought we can work with the D. Mm. We got to upgrade the forwards and we need a goalie.
I'm fast-forwarding a bit here because I want to get to some other things in just the last few minutes here. The Calgary job was a curious one because it was different from all your other jobs. Although you were the general manager for a period of time, it was on you, at least in part, to hire a general manager, which you wind up doing with Treliving. But I never really understood, Brian, what your job was. I never really understood what you did from day to day, what your responsibilities were and weren't. Take 30 seconds and tell me what they were.
Sure. Well, first off, your primary job as president of hockey operations is to make the hockey operations department work. So you spend time every day with your young GM, spend time with a coach every day, spend time with the players every day. Then I think the next biggest thing you do is you oversee the first couple of years. I sit down on all the scouting meetings, make sure they were doing things the way they were supposed to till the GM got up and running. And then the next thing is corporate support and charity work. So your GM, you want him focused on getting the 20 best players on the ice. So your season ticket holder meetings, well, I can do those for him. And he did some, but I did a lot of them. Or sponsor meetings, or we got a tough suite renewal. Someone's got to take this guy for lunch, and all the charity work. And, you know, I worked side by side with Ken King, who was the gentleman that brought me there, yeah. And has been a friend for a long time, and a real smart guy. And it was a great job. But where it goes off the rails is at some point your GM doesn't need that guidance, doesn't need that tutelage. And I even said to Ken when we extended Tree a couple of years ago, I said, now the clock is ticking on me.
All true. But it's not a hockey job. It's not really a hockey job. It's not the job that you had and that you loved doing in Vancouver, in Anaheim, in Toronto. Did you miss that?
I thought I'd miss it a lot more than I did. I thought like draft day would be hard and trade deadline would be hard. But no, I had plenty to say on all major decisions. I was right there when everything was decided. I could have vetoed things if I wanted to, but I didn't. I just would input on things. So no, it was a hockey job, but it's not, you're not driving the bus. The GM's driving the bus,
right.
And you're in the passenger seat barking instructions at him.
Literally a minute and a half. You and I agree on a lot of things. We disagree on a whole bunch too. We've had a few moments over the course of time. What I like about hockey is not always what you like about hockey. You famously used the word truculent when you came to the Toronto Maple Leafs, among other words. How do you like the game today? It's not the game that existed when you came here.
No.
Do you like it?
I like parts of it. It's never been faster. I believe at some point we're going to have to put the red line back in. I look at, you go to a hockey game now. I'm not picking on one team. I was going to say a Leafs game, but I'm not picking on them. Go to in any NHL building. A lot of the breakouts now are just hammered around the wall. Just rim it as hard as you can. There's a guy waiting out near the red line will tip it in, and now they come and they rim it back. And some nights it's like you're watching a tennis match.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't like the amount of hitting in the game. I think a certain amount of hitting is important to our fans. But I think the best test is the hitting came back in the day the playoffs started. The hitting came back in, and it's great hockey right now. We got to find a way to get that intensity back in the regular season for me.
You like what you're doing now? Do you like this broadcasting thing?
I do.
You're back in it?
I do.
Would you like to do it for longer?
Yep.
Wish you good luck with that.
Thank you.
I assume that there's a place for you here, but I don't make all those decisions.
Well, I hope so. I've enjoyed it.
Berkey, you're a good man. We thank you very much for taking the time for us today, and thank you for your friendship over the years.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on, and thank you for your friendship.
Brian Burke, this time on Spotlight.